the mantras. These mantras are for cultivating love, because life is impossible without love. We want to love, we don't want to cause suffering. And to love, we know that we have to be there. How can we love if we're not there? So being there, being present, is a practice. So how do we do it? According to the Buddha, it's very clear, very precise. To be there, you need to bring the mind back to the body and establish yourself in the present moment. There's mindfulness and concentration. The first mantra is, "My dear, I'm here for you. I'm here for you." But you have to be really there to be able to pronounce this mantra. This mantra. If you're not really there, it's not a real mantra. It's just a lip service. Just words, empty. You have to really be there, and that is a deep practice. We need mindfulness and concentration to master the practice of walking, of breathing, to be able to be there. Bring back the mind to the body. This and establishing ourselves in the present moment is the basic practice in Buddhism. So, my dear, I'm here for you. So our presence is a kind of gift for the other person, offering for the one we love. And we know that the most precious gift that we can ever offer the one we love is not anything that we can buy in the supermarket or even at Tiffany's. It's our presence. We offer our presence as something pleasant, gentleness, freshness, peace, solidity. And the practice helps us to become more beautiful, more gentle, more stable. And with each step taken in mindfulness, with each breath, in-breath and out-breath, we cultivate that peace, that beauty, that understanding, that love. Beauty, peace are cultivated. And in Buddhism, these are very concrete. We can cultivate peace, relaxation, and freshness. The pebble meditation that we offer to the children is for that. To recover our freshness, our stability, our beauty. So I'm here. That's not just a proclamation, it's a practice. In Plum Village, we know what to do in order to be really there. Mindfulness of walking, of breathing, when we eat, when we take a bath, when we brush our teeth. Mindfulness and concentration help us to be really there. And we're there first of all for ourselves. Because in Buddhism, love begins with oneself. French, they have a saying, la charité bien ordonnée commence toujours avec soi-même. Charity, properly done, always begins with oneself. So it's the same here. Our presence in the here and now is for our own self first. And because you're really there, you can take care of yourself. You can cultivate peace and relaxation, freshness. And I'm here for you is the second phase. So the first is, I'm here for myself. And as I am really here, I can offer that full presence for you. So we need to have that in order to be able to offer it to the other person. So this is a very deep practice, being there for ourselves and for the other person. The second mantra, I know you're there and I'm happy. When you're fully established in the present moment, when you're really there, you're in a position to recognize the presence of the other person. The presence of the other person. Imagine if that person was no longer there, if she died. If he left you, you would suffer. So recognizing the other person's presence as something very precious for you, that is the purpose of the second mantra. We should not wait until the other person dies to cry and realize how much they meant to you. We have to recognize their presence now so we can practice this mantra every day. My dear, I know you're there, a source of joy, of happiness for me. I'm so glad. So, to love is to be there. That's the first mantra, and that's the definition. And then love is to recognize the presence of the other person. The other person needs to feel recognized, seen, embraced by your mindfulness, your awareness. They're in your heart. They feel embraced by your awareness, your mindfulness. So this is the second mantra that does that. I know you're there. And I'm really happy. We need to learn to practice even if the other person already knows, we should practice. We all need to be reassured. So the second mantra is very important and we should practice it frequently. We can do it with a telephone. We can do it with a letter. All kinds of ways. With a look, with a smile. We can recognize the presence of the other person. And it brings happiness right away to you and to the other person. And who says that Buddhist meditation is difficult? No, it's not difficult. very quickly. These mantras are effective. If it's a true mantra, there's mindfulness, there's concentration, insight in it. And when you say the mantra, it has an immediate effect. You feel the joy, and the other person does as well. Why should we get lost in philosophy, metaphysics? The third mantra is what we need when we see the other person is suffering. I know you suffer. That's why I'm here for you. Suffering is something that happens from time to time to everyone. And if we know how to handle suffering, we can produce happiness. It's just like the mud and the lotus flower. So if we know how to take care of suffering, then we also know how to generate happiness. So sometimes we suffer. We ourselves suffer. The other person suffers. There's suffering in the world. There are wonders in the world. And there are also horrible things in the world. And when you are mindful, you know what's going on in you and around you. And you notice that something isn't right with your loved one. So you should be there for her, for him. And that's why we breathe, we bring our mind back to our own body, we establish ourselves in the present moment, and then we can say to the other person, "My dear, I know you suffer. That's why I'm here." You can do something to help the other person to suffer less, but before you do anything, this mantra can already relieve a lot of suffering. Because when you suffer and the one you love doesn't realize it, you suffer even more. But if your loved one is there and they are aware of what's happening with you, you suffer less. So this mantra brings some relief right away, even before you do anything. When we suffer, we need someone who understands. And that person's presence always soothes the pain. That's what love is. This healing, nourishing presence. Now, I hesitated to talk to the children about the fourth mantra because it's a little bit more difficult to practice because of our pride. Because of our ego, the fourth mantra is a little more difficult to practice. The fourth mantra is one that you should use when you yourself are suffering. My dear, I suffer. Please help me. When you suffer and you think your suffering has come from the one you love, that is a deep suffering. If some other person had done that to you, if some other person had said such a thing to you, you would suffer much less. But it wasn't some other person. It was the person you love the most in the world who did that to you, who said that to you. That's why your suffering is very deep. And you're very deeply wounded. And your tendency is to want to isolate yourself. You would much rather go in your room, lock the door, and cry alone. You don't want that person to come and try to help you. And you also get the unconscious desire to punish them because they made you suffer. They dared to make you suffer. This is what happens very often. If some other person had done it, you would suffer less. But it was the one you love the most who did it. So your suffering is very deep. And what most of us tend to do is to prove to the other person that we can be just fine without them. That's our way of punishing and trying to restore our pride. If the other person does notice that something isn't going right, and they want to help you, but you push them away. You refuse their help. You want to punish them because they have dared to make you suffer. Oh, darling, it seems like you're suffering. You say, me? Suffer? Why should I be suffering? That's your pride. That's your ego. And if the other person comes along and tries to put their hand on your shoulder, you shake them off. Leave me alone. That's your way to punish. Because you're in pain. You want to make the other person suffer. They dared to cause you suffering. And you want to prove that without him, without her, you can survive just fine. It's kind of silly, but this is the reality that most of us react in such a way when we suffer. That's why we need the fourth mantra. My dear, I'm suffering. We have to confess, we have to admit that we're suffering. And we can feel better right away if we just say it out. My dear, I suffer. Please help me. I need you to help me. The thing that prevents you from doing this is pride and arrogance. But in true love, there's no place for pride. In this relationship, you have promised to share everything with him or her. And here is a suffering. Why should you not do what you promised? You promised. We will share everything, happiness and suffering. You're suffering, but you're not sharing it. That's your arrogance, your pride. And it's the desire to punish that is not true love. There's a love story in Vietnam that all the Vietnamese people know. This is the story of the Nam Sung lady, the lady of Nam Sung. It was a young couple. The man's name was Mr. Trung. And her name was Nam Sung. There was a war, and the husband had to go and fight. He had to leave his young wife at home, pregnant. They cried a lot the day he left. And 3 years later, he came back. He was very lucky not to have been killed in the war. And the day he came back, Nam Sung lady and the little boy came to the gate of the town, of the village, to welcome him, full of hope and joy. They embraced, they cried for happiness to be reunited after 3 years of war. And this was the first time that the young man saw his son. And according to the tradition, we always report these kind of events to our ancestors. In every home in Vietnam, there is an ancestor's altar. Even if you're very poor, you have very few things, but you will have an altar for your ancestors. And each morning, you wipe the dust from that table. You light a stick of incense. You take a minute. This is a good practice because during that minute, we get in touch with our ancestors. And that way, we always feel that they're close to us. There is the phenomenon of alienation in our society, but when we practice in this way, it won't happen. We feel our ancestors always there in us, and we are the continuation of our ancestors. And that gives us strength. This isn't Buddhism, but it goes perfectly well with the teaching of the Buddha. So according to tradition, on a special day like this, you have to make a gift to offer to the altar when you announce the return of the father. So the young mother went to the market to buy special foods to offer on the altar to the ancestors. sticky rice, bananas, dishes like that. And while the lady went to the market, Mr. Chung, he tried to talk with his son. He was trying to convince the little boy to get him to call him daddy. Little boy said, "Mister, you're not my daddy. My daddy comes every night. He comes here every night. And my mommy always talks to my daddy. She cries a lot. And every time my mommy sits down, my daddy sits down with her. And every time mommy lies down, he lies down too. And when the young father heard that, he suffered a lot. He saw that someone else had entered his home, that his wife had betrayed him. But that was not what happened. The truth was, that every night she would talk to her own shadow cast on the wall by the kerosene lamp. She would say things like, "My husband, you've been gone so long. How can I raise our child by myself?" And she would cry a lot. She would talk with her own shadow projected on the wall. And one day, little boy came home from the village. He said, "Mommy, all the other boys and girls have a daddy. Why not me?" And it was too difficult to try to explain. He was so young to explain about the war. So she pointed to her shadow on the wall. She said, "This is your daddy. Say good evening, daddy." And the child believed that that shadow was his daddy. So that's why he said, "My daddy comes every night." And mommy talks a long time with him. That's true, she talked. She talked because she was so alone. She cried, and of course, every time his mom sat down, the shadow sat down. Every time the mom laid down, the shadow laid down. But this created a wrong perception in the mind of the young man who had just come home. He believed his wife had betrayed him. You see, a wrong perception can cost you very dearly. That's why in Buddhism, the Buddha said, don't trust too much in your perceptions. And in relationships, there are always wrong perceptions, and if you trust in them too much, you can really lose. So all the happiness vanished from the heart of that young man. He didn't say another word. His heart became a block of ice. And when the woman came back home, he wouldn't look at her, would not speak to her. He became like a stone. And the woman couldn't understand what had happened, why there was this tremendous change. He wouldn't reply to any of her questions. The joy was gone. After the woman came home from the market, though she worked silently, but she suffered. She couldn't understand why her husband wouldn't look at her anymore, wouldn't answer her questions. What happened? And she was very hurt, very, very hurt. And after her offering, their offering was placed on the altar. The young man, the young father, lit the stick of incense and announced his return. And after that, he rolled up the mat and left the house to go to a bar. To try and forget his suffering with drinking. Normally, after this kind of ceremony, after the first person bows to the ancestors, the second person bows. He didn't let her do it. And then after that, they should stay and celebrate together. But he left the house as quickly as he could, went straight to the bar. He couldn't bear the suffering inside of him. He came back home only at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he slept until late the next day, and then he just would go out, get up and go out again. For several days it went on like that. He was trying to drown his sorrows in alcohol. Finally, the young woman could not bear any more of it. She threw herself into the river and she drowned. Her husband wouldn't look at her, wouldn't talk to her. After having heard the news that his wife was dead, the man came back to take care of the child. He lit up the lamp, and the child said, "Mister, there's my daddy." And he pointed at the shadow of his father on the wall. And now, the wrong perception was gone, but it was too late. The young lady was already dead. And all the people in the village, they heard the news, and they built a small memorial for this unfortunate lady, the victim of a wrong perception. And when the emperor came by, he said, "Who is that for?" And the villagers told the story to the emperor, and he wrote a poem that was engraved on that little temple, and it's still there today. This is a true story. And this happens to us as well. We should be very careful not to fall into the trap of our wrong perceptions. That's why when you suffer and you believe that that suffering has been caused by the other person, the one you love the most, you have to act differently. You should practice the fourth mantra. Go to that person and practice the fourth mantra. "My dear, I'm suffering. I need you to help me. Please explain to me why you did that to me. Why you said that to me. There must be a reason. I need your help. That is the practice of the fourth mantra. We should not allow pride to prevent us. And that young woman didn't do it, and the young man didn't do it. The Namsung lady could have asked her husband with the fourth mantra, "My dear husband, I'm suffering. I suffer. Why? Since I came home from the market, you don't look at me anymore. You don't talk to me anymore. Have I done some horrible thing for you to treat me like that? Please help me. Please explain." That would be the fourth mantra practice. She didn't do it. And the young man the same. He should have spoken to his wife. "My wife, I'm suffering enormously. The little boy told me that his father comes here every night. Who is that person? You have to tell me why you did that thing like that to me." That's the fourth mantra. It's very important. And if either one of the two had practiced the fourth mantra, they would have been able to avoid that tragedy. So, my dear friends, I wish that you do the same, that you do not commit the same error that they did. The next time that you suffer, and you believe your suffering was caused by the other person, don't be like Mr. Chung. Don't be like the Namsung lady. We should practice the fourth mantra. Go to that person. Send an email, a letter. "My dear, I'm suffering. I need you to help me. I need you to explain why you did that to me." There are some sentences that you can use to practice this fourth mantra. You can write them down on a piece of paper, like the size of a credit card. That's enough. The first sentence, "Darling, I suffer. And I want you to know." We have to confess it. We have to declare that we are suffering. We shouldn't say, "Suffer? I'm not suffering." No. We have to say it to the other person. We have to tell them we're suffering. "Darling, I suffer, and I want you to know." And if you just even write it down on a piece of paper to the other person, you already suffer less, because you have gotten your pride out of the way and communicated about your suffering. It's effective immediately. Even if you haven't discussed the matter, but you just write down on a piece of paper, "I'm suffering, my dear. And I want you to know." You're true to your promise. You promise to share, right? Both the good and the bad. for better or for worse. My dear, I'm suffering, and I want you to know. The second sentence, I'm doing my best. I'm a practitioner of the Dharma. I'm not reacting just like everyone else. When anger or suffering is in me, I'm not going to talk. I'm not going to react in speech or action while that anger or suffering is overcoming me, because I can create more anger, more suffering. So when the suffering rises up, I come back to my breathing. I breathe in and out. I do walking meditation to allow my anger to calm down. I'm a practitioner. And the Buddha taught me that I need to learn how to handle my suffering, and that's what I'm doing right now. I'm embracing my suffering and looking deeply into that suffering with walking meditation, with mindful breathing. The exercises created by the Buddha for soothing pain, in order not to make it worse. The Buddha recommended to us that when anger is there, we shouldn't say or do anything. We should come back to ourself. With the practice, we can recognize and embrace that suffering and look deeply into it. And when we look deeply, we can discover the nature, the roots, the source of that suffering, that anger. It may come from a wrong perception. And we humans, we are very often the victims of wrong perceptions. The Buddha said that. We are not yet saints. So wrong perceptions are part of daily life. The Buddha told us not to put too much faith in our perceptions. When you meditate, you can look into, deeply into your perceptions. Look deeply into your suffering and see if it comes from a wrong perception. Maybe when you practice on your own in that way, you can discover your wrong perception. And the whole problem is already resolved. You don't even need any help from the other person. But as a true practitioner, that's what we do when the anger comes up. So the first line, my dear, I'm suffering and I want you to know. Second line, I'm doing my best, I'm practicing. And that's a kind of indirect invitation for the other person to practice too. Maybe the other person is also a practitioner, and that person will ask themselves, what did I do? What did I say that my loved one is suffering like that? So it's a kind of indirect invitation for the other person also to practice looking deeply. The other person may be proud of you for not being like anyone else, that you're a practitioner when your anger is coming up or you're suffering, that you know what to do and what not to do. You know not to speak or act from a place of anger, and the other person appreciates that you're a practitioner. They have respect for you. So the third sentence for your credit card size piece of paper. I need your help. Because maybe when you've been practicing on your own, you haven't been able to reach that enlightenment, the transformation of the suffering. So you say, I need your help. Please help me. That's the third sentence for practicing the fourth mantra. So you can go to the other person and say these things, but if you're not sure you have enough calm, then you can do it in written form. You can write the three sentences and put that on his or her desk, table. After having done that, you feel a lot better and you can continue your practice. And if during your practice you discover an error on your part, you can write another note to the other person to let them know that you're now free of that suffering. Our friends who come to Plum Village have written down these three sentences on a little credit card size piece of paper and slipped it into their wallet. And every time they suffer, every time we suffer and we think it's come from the other person, we can pull out that piece of paper and look at it. It's the Buddha right there in your wallet, at your fingertips, and you will know exactly what you should do and what you should not do. We should practice the fourth mantra. We should not repeat the mistake of Mr. Chung. We know that the five mindfulness trainings are a Buddhist vision for a global ethic and everyone is invited to translate the trainings into language that's non-Buddhist, because the five mindfulness trainings are based on the inside of awakened beings, non-discrimination, as a practitioner, we can always share our practice with others, Buddhist and also non-Buddhist. So we can translate it into secular language. Non-religious terms. President Sarkozy in France has wanted to reintroduce morality and ethics into the curriculum. So what do we want to teach the young people in school? We have some ideas. The child can learn to calm her body, relax, to deal with a painful feeling in the body or in the mind. A child can very well learn how to use gentle, loving speech and deep listening. And the practice of the five mindfulness trainings they can very well be in full respect of a secular society. And we want to train teachers who can share these ethical teachings, share about how to relax the body, how to handle emotions, learn how to speak and to listen. To consume in such a way that the mind and the body and a whole planet can be well. Loving speech, deep listening, restoring communication, these are essential things that we should all be taught in school. If the teacher knows the practice, he or she can transmit that to the students. So I'm calling on everyone to share about this in your community. When we recognize suffering, when we get in touch with suffering, and when we look deeply into suffering, understanding and love always come. In our society, we have a fear of suffering. We don't want to get in touch with it. But to understand, suffering is very essential, the suffering in us and in the other person. And with mindful breathing, we can have the strength and the space to be in touch with the suffering and look deeply into it. And when we're able to understand the suffering inside, we suffer less. We have compassion and understanding. And when we then turn out to the other person, we can see the suffering in him or in her, and it's much easier for us to understand. So, the third mantra can be practiced. I see the suffering in you. I know you suffer. And when we recognize the suffering in the other person, we no longer have any desire to retaliate or to punish. The other person is suffering. He needs help, not punishment. That's why we need to see the suffering in people, even criminals. And if we recognize the suffering in ourselves and understand that suffering, then we can look at others with the eyes of compassion. This is doable. To look at others with the eyes of love, of understanding. And when we look in that way, we don't suffer and the other person suffers less because of our look. There's no anger, discrimination in our eyes. Just to look and in such a way is good for the whole world. So getting in touch with suffering, understanding suffering, is a very deep practice in Buddhism. The art of happiness, reconciliation, and joy. The first noble truth, suffering, ill-being, gives rise to the third, which is the cessation of suffering, well-being. The fourth mindfulness training is the practice of deep listening, compassionate listening. We listen to our own suffering and we listen to the suffering of the other person. If you are able to listen to your own suffering, then you can very well listen to someone else's suffering. My dear, I know you suffer, and I'm here for you. If communication has become difficult or impossible, it's because you don't see the suffering in the other person. You think that only you are suffering. That's not right. The other one is suffering too. Maybe even more. So we have to look at the other person in a way that we see their suffering. So loving speech comes from that. My dear, I know you've suffered a lot these past 3, 4, 5 years. We have to recognize the suffering in that person. And you can continue speaking like this. I have not been able to help you to suffer less. In fact, I have reacted in a way that your suffering actually became worse. We have to admit that we've failed. We've reacted in a way that allowed the other person's suffering to grow. In the past, we didn't know the practice, but now we know the practice. So we should look at the other person, see their suffering, and practice the third mantra. My dear, I know you've suffered a lot. Unfortunately, in the past, I wasn't able to help you, and I actually made things worse. I reacted in such a way that the situation became worse. It's not my intention to make you suffer. It's because I didn't know your suffering. I didn't intend to make that worse. This is what we have to say. I don't want you to suffer. I just didn't know what to do. And I made mistakes. But I don't want to continue like that. I know I've made you suffer because I didn't understand. But I am starting now to try to understand, and I need your help. I need you to tell me what's in your heart. I'm ready now to listen, because we have learned the practice of deep listening. I need to know to understand your suffering, so would you help me? Tell me what is in your heart. I want to listen with all of my heart to the suffering in you, because I don't want to make you suffer more. I want to help you. But if you don't tell me how, I can't do it. I need your help. This is the practice of loving speech. And if we don't see the suffering of the other person, then we cannot honestly use this language. I remember a retreat in Germany. Some people came to me on the last day and told me that with their cell phones, they had, and using this practice, they had been able to reconcile with their fathers through the practice of deep listening and loving speech. Because on the next to last day of the retreat, everyone was encouraged to practice this, to reconcile with the other person, even if that person wasn't there at the retreat. And these four men came and told me, "Tai, you know, before this retreat, I never would have believed that I could talk with my father like that, gently. There was so much anger in me. I couldn't speak to my father in such a way, so gently. But after 4 days of practicing, I could see his suffering. And that's why, when I started to speak, I was surprised to find that I could speak lovingly. I could open my heart to him, and we could reconcile. It's a miracle. And these miracles of reconciliation happen in every retreat of mindfulness all over the world. In Macau, Hong Kong, Singapore, in the United States, everywhere. So when we look and we see the suffering of the other person, we will be able to look at the person with eyes of compassion. We'll be able to talk with him or her with loving speech, and that will open the other person's heart, and they will be able to empty what they've been carrying. And you practice like the Bodhisattva of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassionate listening. The Bodhisattva is you. You let the Bodhisattva of deep listening manifest. That Bodhisattva isn't living up there in the clouds. He's in you, the Bodhisattva of compassion. You have to give that Bodhisattva a chance to manifest. And this kind of conversation can change everything. It can transform a lot. And reconciliation is possible. The miracle of reconciliation happens all the time with the practice. And when the person speaks, you listen. And you practice mindfulness of listening. You practice compassion. Perhaps that person will say things that are wrong. Maybe he or she will have a lot of wrong perceptions. In their comments. There may be reproach, blaming, accusation, bitterness. In what they say. But none of that prevents you from sitting and listening with compassion. We should not react. We don't interrupt the person. Even if there are wrong perceptions, even if there's blaming, bitterness, because you're the Bodhisattva, you are practicing deep compassionate listening, and you let the person talk. Even with blame, bitterness, and wrong perception, you say this to yourself, what I'm doing right now is just listening. I can listen. If I do this for a half an hour or an hour, it will do a lot of good. My aim is to give that person a chance to empty, to pour out their heart in order to suffer less. My aim is not to have a debate about the accuracy of what the person says. My purpose is to help the person suffer less. So you have to keep that mindfulness in your heart the whole time you listen. And if you can maintain that mindfulness, then what that person says will not even irritate you. Things that you could say to correct, you don't say right now. You just listen. And you know that later on, there will be an opportunity to offer some information to help the other person correct their perception, but not right now. Right now is just listening. We sit in peace. With a lot of compassion, this is possible. We should maintain, keep that energy of compassion alive. And we say to ourselves, I'm listening with one aim only, to offer that person a chance to pour out their heart so they can suffer less. That's all. And if you can maintain that, you keep the compassion alive, and what that person says cannot touch irritation or anger in you because you're protected by the energy of compassion. Compassion is an energy that protects you. As a practitioner, you should know how to generate the energy of compassion. It protects you and it protects others. Anger destroys, compassion protects. So when you are protected by this compassion, then the seeds of irritation and anger don't get watered, even if the other person says things that otherwise would water those seeds. You're protected. It is possible for all of us. And you know there will be time later on to skillfully help that person correct their perception. So you can listen. You're at peace and you're a true bodhisattva. You're full of compassion. The bodhisattva is you. So the fourth mindfulness training is about loving speech and deep listening. It can restore communication. Nowadays we have very sophisticated means for communicating, and yet we communicate very badly. We have very fancy instruments, but communication is blocked. The Buddha's instrument was listening, compassionate listening, and loving speech. That is what opens the door of the person's heart, restoring communication. And realizing reconciliation is possible. And these things can be taught in the school. The dad should practice with the son. The mom should practice with her daughter, her son. In the community, we should practice in this way so that we can have harmony, happiness. As a parent or a teacher, you can share the practice with your children and your students. The fifth mindfulness training is the practice of mindful consumption. If we suffer, it's because we haven't known how to consume properly. There are four kinds of food. In Buddhism, we speak of four kinds of food. The first kind of food is edible food, what we take in through the mouth, what we eat and drink. And it can bring in a lot of poison. We should eat and drink with mindfulness. When you go to the market, you need your mindfulness. Know what to buy and what not to buy. We should have conversations in the family about this, to know what do we want to buy, what do we not want to buy. This is to love our body, to protect our body and the body of our family. This is about edible food. And we should talk with our children about this. This body is something very precious, offered to us by our parents and our ancestors. We should look at it in such a way. We should preserve our health by the way we eat and drink. The second kind of food is sense impressions. We consume not by eating here, but through our eyes, our ears, our skin, our mind. For example, when you watch television, you're consuming. And what you consume could be very toxic. It can be very toxic because there's violence, there's fear. When you look at movies like that, you allow that fear and violence to enter you. That's not good. Not good for you. Not good for your children. When you read a newspaper, you consume. Because the article you're reading may contain a lot of toxins. Discrimination, fear, anger, despair. These can bring depression. So we need to maintain a good physical and mental health through mindful consumption. Even a conversation is consumption. You might feel lonely, you want to go talk with somebody, but that conversation may be harmful. There could be hatred, anger, or despair in the conversation. And if you're not mindful, when you listen, those energies can enter your body and your mind. Just a conversation can do that. It can be harmful. When we listen to a Dharma talk, there's no toxins in there. It waters the good seeds in us. But we need to be aware if we listen to someone venting out anger and despair, if we're not mindful. The third kind of food is volition. Volition. So first one is edible food. Second is sense impressions. The third is volition. What is that volition? It's a very potent kind of food, nutriment. It's our intention. It's our deepest desire. Each one of us has a deep intention, a deep desire that is like an energy. When we're very alive and active, it's because we have an intention, a desire to do something, to realize something. It's a source of life. It's also a source of food. Without this energy, we're not very much alive. We want to realize something. want to accomplish something. That's our volition, our intention, our desire, our motivation. But some desires, some intentions may be unhealthy. Like a terrorist, that person's intention is to punish, to make someone suffer. He is living in order to avenge, to punish. That intention, that desire is not good. That is not good food for our mind and body. But if you have the intention to protect the planet, to make others happy, that's a good intention. That's the intention of the Buddha. That's a good food for your mind. If you're motivated by the desire to practice, to transform, and to help the transformation of others, that's a good desire, a good intention. So we have to choose. If you think your intention is to get lots of money and fame, power, in order to be happy, that's not a very good food, because there are people who have plenty of those things and they suffer. They're not happy. People with lots of power suffer. From loneliness, isolation. They're very wealthy. Very powerful people who take their own life. So we know, if the object of your desire is money, power, fame, sex, you know that those are not wholesome intentions. We can destroy ourselves by pursuing those things. We can destroy our body and our mind with that kind of motivation. But if our intention is to learn, to train, to practice in order to transform, to help others to suffer less, so there can be more happiness, that's a wholesome intention. That's the intention of the Bodhisattvas and the Buddha. So we have to make a choice. So we should sit down and look deeply and ask ourselves, what is my deepest desire? What do I want to offer in my life? What do I want to do with this life? So this third category of food is volition. The Buddha recommends the mind of love, bodhicitta. That's a good seed. Bodhicitta is the desire, the intention to practice the Dharma in order to liberate oneself and liberate others. To love oneself and to love others. The mind of love, the mind of awakening. And then fourthly, consciousness, the collective consciousness is the fourth kind of food, the collective energy. Collective consciousness. when you came to Plum Village, when you come here, you meet people who want to practice to transform. And that consciousness is guided by the intention to make peace in oneself and with other people. And all together, we can generate a good energy. The energy of mindfulness, the energy of peace, of relaxation, of harmony. And that is an object of consumption, an item of consumption. A light energy, an energy of peace, of brotherhood and sisterhood, collective energy. When we invite the bell to sound, everyone stops their thinking, stops their speaking, and begins to be mindful of their breathing in and out, enjoying their breath. And all together we create an energy of mindfulness, an energy of concentration, of peace and relaxation. And that energy is something that we consume. It's good. It heals. So this is the fourth kind of food, fourth kind of food that we consume. If you are hanging around with people who are always full of anger and violence, then the collective consciousness is harmful. And you don't want to leave your child in an environment like that. We need to reflect and create the conditions for this fourth kind of food, positive collective consciousness, to help us to transform and to nourish us. So if you are in an environment that is toxic, you know that the collective energy is not healthy for you, not for your children. You need to think about this. You shouldn't stay in that kind of situation because you're consuming it. It's very harmful. You have to go somewhere else. You need to create a healthier environment where the collective consciousness will help give you peace and joy and happiness. That's a kind of production. We cannot buy it in the supermarket. So Sangha building is very important. As a practitioner, you want to go back home and build a Sangha, a community of practice. And when you have a community of practitioners in which each person can breathe, walk, speak, think correctly, we can generate. It's a song. And that is what is the meaning of the Sangha. So as a Buddhist practitioner, you know there are three jewels. The Buddha jewel, the Dharma jewel, and the Sangha is a jewel, the community. If you have a good Sangha, that Sangha is the bearer. It contains the jewels of the Buddha and the Dharma. We need to build a Sangha in order to practice, to maintain the practice. So everyone is encouraged to build a Sangha back at home with the five mindfulness trainings. You can read them every week or every 2 weeks. You can do walking meditation to walk in the kingdom of God. You do these kinds of things as a Sangha. So when we receive the five mindfulness trainings, we know that we have a path, we have a practice. And now that we have a path, we no longer need to fear. We know where we're going. And we can share our path with others, with the Sangha. Every time a person receives the five mindfulness trainings, I feel very happy because that person has found their way. And that is a happiness for him or her. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha will be with that person their whole life. And that person will suffer less. And we will be able to have beauty and joy in their life.